I'm Blake Hardcastle. This is the Stories You've Missed podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the podcast, Stories You've Missed. These are accounts of God's amazing grace in the lives of ordinary people at Grand Parkway Baptist Church. I'm your host, Blake Hardcastle, and I serve as a spiritual formation pastor at Grand Parkway. And this podcast is designed to aid in the building up of this local body by retelling the kindness of God. My guest today is Clyde Copeland. Many of you know Clyde. He is the worship pastor here at Grand Parkway, but he grew up in Georgia and Indiana. He spent lots of time around Christian camps. He studied music ed and his undergrad at Indiana University Bloomington and theology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, Southwestern. He was a music ed teacher in Natchitoches and Baton Rouge, and he's actually an accomplished baker. He's married to Nicole. They have four children, and he has been the worship pastor at Grand Parkway for 9.5 years. Welcome, Clyde.
Thanks for having me.
And so today, Clyde and I are going to talk about how he's experienced God's grace in really becoming a worship pastor here at Grand Parkway. And so I want to start with, what was your experience with music like growing up? Did you always dream you'd be a worship pastor?
No, not always. My experience with music was very positive growing up. My whole family, everybody sang. My mom sang, my dad sang, my brother sang. Music was just a part of what we did. We sang at church, family gatherings. We'd sing in the car. So,
and what would you guys be singing? Like
everything from, you know, when we're at church, you're singing, you know, hymns. Right. And I remember being 6 or 7 years old in the car with my mom. She was flipping through the radio, and Herman's Hermits came on, and they were singing, you know, "What a Wonderful World It Would Be." Don't know much about history, and I was hooked. I was like, "Mom, what is this?" And she was like, "That's the oldies." And I was like, "Well, I'm in love." Yeah. It was this radio station out of Atlanta, Fox 97. And I mean, that's what I grew up listening to.
Yeah.
Was just, you know, until probably middle school. And then my tastes, I would say they changed as much as expanded.
But, right.
You know, from an early age, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, Rolling Stones, Motown, all that stuff. And then, you know, getting out of, you know, my music education was really piano. I didn't have music in middle school.
When did you begin playing piano?
I was five or six.
That were these forced piano lessons, or
they were forced at first. Even though I'm sure I told my mom I wanted to take piano, but you know, everybody, if you do something long enough, hits that wall.
Yeah,
I don't want to do this anymore.
Right,
I don't want to practice. The fun is gone.
Right.
But I had a great piano teacher. I mean, I think as a kid, I enjoyed piano until I got into about middle school, and it just got harder. And then, you know, the way we approached it changed. But, you know, yeah, so the piano was a part of the music ed, but elementary school, we had no music education. So church and piano lessons and being around family, that was my, and the radio, was my musical input.
Who else, anybody else play in your family? Your mom or
my dad? Mom plays piano.
Okay.
So my brother and dad, they just sang. My brother, he's still alive. My dad died years ago, but
the four of you, could you have done a four-part harmony? Are the voices married?
My dad didn't really sing harmony, my brother didn't really either.
Okay.
So my mom and I are the harmony singers.
Okay.
My dad and brother could, you know.
Did you have a bass, baritone, tenor, and soprano?
No.
No alto?
None of us are really basses. My mom's a tenor. My mom embarrassed me for years because she could sing lower than I could until I was probably, you know, a sophomore in high school.
All the old school R&B.
Yeah.
All those divas, yes.
Yeah.
Now, you also play guitar and hammer dulcimer. What else do you play?
I would say, you know, somewhat proficiently, I play piano. and then, because I mean, that was my minor in my undergrad was piano.
Yeah.
And then for the guitar, it was really just, you know, every kid wants to learn how to play guitar probably. And so I'm very much self-taught when it comes to guitar. And then self-taught on the hammer dulcimer, learned it so I could play some Andrew Peterson and Rich Mullins music. And then beyond that, I mean, I can goof around with a harmonica.
Oh, okay.
And I can pick up most instruments and make a sound, but not necessarily play them.
Right.
You know, I don't want to be behind the drums.
Right.
I would play that way too loud. I can play the bass and, you know, electric and acoustic things like that.
Okay. Now, you've not always worked in ministry. Talk to us about, you know, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Yeah. So growing up, I always thought I would be a camp manager.
Okay.
Like my dad was.
Your dad was a camp manager.
Yeah.
And a manager of like a a Christian camp.
Yeah. So when I grew up, my mom was when my parents met, they were both at Southwestern Seminary in Fort Worth. They were both wanting to go into camp ministry. My mom got a degree in church recreation I don't know if they still offer that as a degree, but, and then my dad, similar, although he got a different degree, but they met, they wanted to go into camp ministry. They worked at a camp in Georgia for a few years and then went to another camp in North Georgia, which is where I grew up, outside of Jasper. And, it was a great place to grow up. I mean, I just, you know, I had 640 acres in the North Georgia mountains to, you know, romp and play in, and I had a hard time fathoming anything else. And then that camp got sold. It was owned by an association by the Southern Baptist Convention there. Got sold to Young Life, and you know, as a kid, I was like, I hate Young Life. I didn't know anything about them. I just knew that they were the reason I didn't get to live at that camp anymore.
Now, what is it a Young Life camp today?
I think it is. Yeah, I think it's called Sharp Top Cove.
Sharp Top. Okay.
But it was called Burnt Mountain Baptist Assembly. Yeah. And so they bought up more. It looks totally different than what it did when I was a kid.
You thought growing up, yeah, camp ministry, mm-hmm. this is awesome. This is great stuff.
Yeah. It had so much going on. I mean, you would hear great preaching when different people came in, but you would do all the RA stuff when they still had RAs, mm-hmm. Royal Ambassadors, mm-hmm. and GAs. You know, it's like Boy Scouts for Baptists pretty much. And the knots, the campfires, the tent camping, the hiking, all that was a part of growing up.
And even today, you and Nicole both really enjoy camping.
Mm. Absolutely.
Like a preferred family vacation.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think our last camping trip, our tent got destroyed, so we have to get a new tent. But our last one before we had a baby was we went to Big Bend National Park in Garner State Park in Texas, and it was amazing.
I've heard that's a lifer. That's a bucket list park to go to.
It's great. Yeah, it takes a long time to get to. I mean, from here it's like 10 hours, but we really enjoy camping. Our kids love camping.
Yeah.
Some people look at us like we're crazy when we take, you know, our three, now four kids. We haven't taken our newest camping yet, but hopefully here in the next few months we will.
Yeah. Okay. How did you get to Houston? So you Georgia, Indiana, you taught in Louisiana in you went to undergrad.
Yeah.
How did you pick music ed?
So I picked music ed really, it probably starts with a guy named Tim James. Mr. James was my high school choir teacher and really had the biggest influence on me in that season of my life, from even middle school, because I met him when I was in middle school. I got to be in the high school musical that year, which was Sound of Music.
Okay.
I played one of the kids.
Okay.
So that's when I first met him. And then when I got into high school, I did everything I could to be around Mr. James, because he was a great teacher, you know, very formative in my life. And I realized probably by my junior year, I want to do something with music. And so I didn't know if that would mean being a performer, or if that would mean teaching, or if that means something else. And he sat me down. He's just like, listen, you got to make a choice. You can pursue the performance route. You need to know that's a dog eat dog world. Mm-hmm. Most people don't make it. And you know, his bedside manner was real, real, real positive. But I mean, I needed that. We all need that. Somebody will just tell you the truth. And the other thing he said was, now if you want to have a family and, you know, have some stability, then you need to look at teaching music, which is what I decided to do. I wanted to be a choir teacher just like he was. And so that's what I went to Indiana University to do.
Was there an appeal to impact other students the way you've been impacted by him?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
He was kind of a model for you.
Yeah. And by that point, I'd already started teaching. I was doing piano lessons. I wasn't very good at it, but I mean, I had that urge to help others, you know, to help teach people how to, you know, do this.
And so you did your undergrad, and are you thinking, yep, I'm going right to the schools? And or was there?
Yeah, I wanted to be a high school choir teacher.
Okay.
Which I didn't end up doing. I did it for my student teaching, but my first job was not in high school choir. It was middle school choir and then teaching kids in like elementary school general music.
Now, middle school anything takes a special breed of human being.
Brutal.
I think music, middle school choir is more like, I'm inviting everyone to screw around here.
Oh my gosh. It was, don't get me wrong, I say brutal. There were days, I mean, it was my first job, so who's good at their first job, right?
Right.
But there were some days it was sweet, it was beautiful, it was great. And then there were other days you're just like, I forgot this was the worst time of my life, was when I was in middle school. So what made me think I wanted to go do it for somebody else?
Right. I want to hang out with everybody. This is the worst version of them.
Because the kids are just in that phase of they're leaving that kind of innocence.
Yeah.
And things get real, real quick.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. But, you know, I did that for 2 years. I taught in middle school for 1 year. And then the next year, so that was after Natchitoches, I went to Baton Rouge and taught for a year there. It was just elementary school, general music.
Now, at this point, you're still thinking, okay, let me get out of middle school. Let me get to elementary. Is it still kind of, let me go to high school? Or are you, when did things begin
to change? I would have been open to that. Let me back up. 2006, I'm still in Indiana. I'm in college. I'm just finished my sophomore year, getting ready to start to be a junior. That's when I meet my future wife, Nicole. We're figuring out what is this going to look like for us down the road, right? In 2006, we hated each other. I was dating somebody else.
We met
at the camp. Yeah. So I was working there. She was on staff. And I was working there. She was a summer missionary through the North American Mission Board with, 10 others. And we were oil and water.
Okay.
We did not mix. I would walk in her room.
The opposites hadn't attracted yet.
No, not at all. And I was dating somebody else at the time. It was comical how much we did not get along. By the end of the summer.
If someone had told you then, oh, by the way, that's your future wife.
Oh, my gosh. I would have been like.
Stone this man. He is not a prophet.
Yeah. He's on something. Yeah. So by the end of the summer, things aren't quite as bad. And we both really had a call and a pull towards missions.
Yeah.
We both talked about the Journeyman program a lot at that time.
Which in Southern Baptist culture, it's a 2-year commitment somewhere overseas.
That's right.
And provide stability to the local missionary. And really, you're kind of figuring out, am I going to do this for a career or not?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And both of us felt, we were kind of wading through that.
What year are you in undergrad at this point?
I just finished my sophomore. So I was getting ready to be a junior. She's getting ready to be a senior. She's a year older than me. She goes back, kind of finishes her senior year.
And where is she in school?
She's at Florida State.
Okay.
And
the only way you would have met is at this camp.
Yeah. Okay. And what's funny is we kept in touch, I didn't really keep in touch much with other folks. I mean, this Facebook is just kind of getting going. So you can, it's more than just calling people on the phone.
You had to have .edu to get on Facebook back in
the day.
That's
right. Yeah. This was when it was still the real deal. But we would call each other. I didn't really do that with anybody else. And I'd broken up with my girlfriend and I didn't necessarily see anything there. We were just kind of friends, which was comical again, because we didn't get along. And so, anyway, fast forward to the next summer of 2007. She is going to do Journeyman now. She's graduated.
She's applied to the program.
She's going to be going to Central Asia as a journeyman. And
her undergrad is in geology?
Geology. And she comes up to Indiana to see all of us before she leaves, all of her friends from last summer.
Okay.
Which was
during summer camp?
Great. So I'm still at the camp. I'm still working there. My bosses, they're all still there. So she comes up and we realized there's something here.
There's a spark at that
point. And it wasn't, I'm your boyfriend, you're my girlfriend necessarily, but we realized there was something there. And so we wrote each other a lot. I say that. She wrote me more than I wrote her. I was not great while she was overseas, but as soon as she got back, 2009, I'm graduating from IU. I'm kind of planning on doing Journeyman now.
Okay.
But
she's already overseas.
Yeah.
And she's been there for about a year.
Yeah.
Okay.
2 years, 2009. So she's done. Yeah. Okay. So fast forward 2 years, she's done. And I am figuring out, do I want to do Journeyman or do I want to pursue marriage?
Because
you can't do both. You got to pick one or the other.
Yeah.
And so what happened was we had the 2008 financial crisis. Well, the board said we can't send any more Journeyman. So life got quick real.
That wasn't an option.
Real quick. Because I was like, okay, I got to get a job now.
Yeah.
And Nicole, when she had finished Journeyman, she was planning to start her master's at LSU. Mm-hmm. And as soon as she got back, I flew down to Florida. I said, hey, I'm ready to pursue you. Mm-hmm. So we started a relationship.
Okay.
And she's like, yeah, this guy's serious. I haven't seen her in 2 years. I fly down to Florida. I haven't met her parents or anything like that.
Yeah.
Flew down on Father's Day weekend, which was a bit of a gamble, meet her parents and all that. And they didn't try to scare me off or anything. They were good about it. But, by that end of the summer, I'm looking for jobs in Louisiana.
How well did they get to know you that weekend?
Oh, not super well.
Okay.
I mean.
Did you ask your dad, hey, I like.
No.
Okay. All right.
No, I dident do any of that.
Okay.
End of the summer, I'm looking for jobs in Louisiana. I find that job, and you know, from there things just move so fast.
Yeah.
We're engaged by
December.
She's
in grad school there.
She's in grad school. Yeah. We're 2.5 hours away. So we go back and forth, see each other on weekends. I start saving for a ring the day I get that job offer to be a teacher. Because I knew this is who I want to be with. During Thanksgiving, I went.
So for guys who are listening and they're thinking, I was saving for a ring. How much were you putting away a week, a month? What were you trying to do?
I did not have a lot of disposable income. So, I mean, I think I spent like $3,000 for the engagement ring and the wedding ring, the band. I'm not giving advice to guys to other than this to say,
you're not a jeweler or
every woman's different. My wife's not, you know, I wanted a huge 10 carat diamond ring or anything, but, I think the common wisdom at the time was, you know, a month's salary or something like that, which is not far from what I was making.
Yeah.
But anyway,
You started saving. You're like, okay,
I started saving. And I took my Christmas bonus. I didn't know what a bonus was. I never got one of those before. I had a real job. So I took that and I'll put all that towards it. And anyway, so proposed. She says yes. And we get married, you know. So we, from dating to marriage, we were together 9 months.
Okay.
And then, you know, we weren't messing around.
Yeah.
And because we're still thinking we may be on the mission field. You know?
Right.
So I need to
get
to seminary.
Yeah.
All this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So she has an internship in Plano. So right after we get married, we move to Plano. We're there for the summer. She's got to go back though and finish her master's at LSU.
Okay.
And I wasn't going to, you know, live in Natchitoches while she's doing that. So I told them in Natchitoches, I love y'all, but I've got to move on. And so I found a job teaching in Baton Rouge.
I get you Baton Rouge. Okay.
And which was, it was kind of our first full year living together marriage. It was great.
So you do first time teacher all over again.
All
your
over
second
again.
Year,
new second, school.
Your second first year.
No, and it's not choir. It's general music. I mean, I would do choirs with the kids, but it's general music. And I taught in kind of an inner city school in Baton Rouge.
What are some parts of general? Is that like the recorder? What is general music? Is that?
I mean, people think recorder. They think of doing like the ORF instruments, the xylophones, and stuff like that. I had none of that.
Okay.
I mean, I had no budget.
Okay.
I mean, it was them giving me a job and me going, I'll do whatever it takes to do this job. And so, I mean, they were like, hey, can you teach reading too? And I'm like, yeah, I'll teach reading, whatever you want me to do. And so we would, I was making a lot of that up as I went. I mean, I had some basic standards that I knew I needed the kids to learn. So what instrument does everybody carry around with them? Well, their voice. So everything I did was very, they call it like the Kadai method, but it's really geared around singing, especially a lot of folk songs.
Okay.
And then we got to, it was interesting. We got to February, which is Black History Month. And I decided, well, I'm just going to do a curriculum and teach the kids basically Black music throughout American history.
Okay.
And we started with, you know, we call like African American spirituals, things like
spirituals,
Swing Low Sweet Chariot. And then, you know, fast forward, we're right up the road from New Orleans. So we did some stuff on jazz.
Okay.
And then we went to R&B and then we went into, you know, rock and roll and disco. And I think by the time we were done, we had made it to like, you know, James Brown or something like that. So it was fun. And so you're doing everything from teaching the kids, you know, meter and melody and things like that. But you're also letting them have fun and do dances and stuff.
Yeah.
This is before TikTok, but kids would dance. So.
Yeah.
So that was, I mean, a really positive experience. Again, difficult to teach in for me, just because the socioeconomics, you know, of being at that particular school was just, it was difficult to see, you know, I grew up in a home where I had a lot of support from my parents and most of the kids that went to school with me, you know, it's not like everybody was perfect and everything was always great, but it was totally different going to teaching a school where, there's a lot of poverty and you're seeing, you know, kids they're being raised by their grandparents and, you know, they're just lucky they came to school that day. So we were in Baton Rouge and it was interesting because during this time I was not leading worship at a church.
Okay.
I started leading worship when I was in high school and in college and then started my first job as a worship leader at my church in college. Did it for about 4 years and then took a break, obviously. Did some in Natchitoches as well. And we left there. And then it was great because my first year of marriage, Nicole, I just got to go to church with my wife. Singing and worship together. Mm-hmm. It was great. We were at a wonderful church in Baton Rouge called The Ring at the time. They've changed their name now. But it was weird to, you know, stand out in the congregation and feel like, I feel like I should be helping up there.
Okay. And yet at because the same time, in the past, or you had something
because I'd always done it. Okay. You know, I'd always been up there.
Yeah.
And
or was there ever kind of like, these people stink. Let me get up there and help
you. No, not at all. There was actually a little bit of, I'm intimidated by them.
Oh,
they're good.
Okay.
I mean,
they don't need my help.
Well, I'd never been able to be at a church where, it's funny, you know, my other churches where I led, very old school, you know, it was me sitting at a piano or behind a guitar, and we would do some newer stuff, but it's not like I had drums and a band and electric guitar, right? Those things to give you that big band pop rock sound, just didn't have them. So all of a sudden I was at a church that had all that, and I'm like, man, this feels good. This really meets my preferences. Yeah. This is like, this is the what you would hear at Passion or something like that, right? And I went to my first Passion in 2007, which I just realized was 15 years ago. Because Passion's happening right now.
Right now,
2022.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so old. But so back to that church in Baton Rouge, it was a great experience. And then we decided to move to Houston because Nicole got a job offer with BP. I had started seminary when we lived in Plano and was doing some stuff online.
So that's Texas, that's Southwestern.
That's right. Yeah. And then we moved to Baton Rouge. I'm doing stuff. And then we moved to Houston because Nicole gets a job offer with BP. They had a campus here.
Extension campus, yeah. And you're still thinking preparing for the mission field.
We both at that point were like, we want to go with the International Mission Board and be missionaries.
Yeah.
And so to do that, you had to get a degree.
Right.
At least one of you. And so I start working on my master's, and as soon as we moved here, a friend of mine told me, check out Grand Parkway. And so we did.
Now, were you working, or were you a full-time student, or were you?
I was a full-time student. Okay. So I quit teaching because Nicole, she got her job. She was a petroleum geologist with BP, which, you know, if y'all have worked in the energy industry, they don't do so bad.
She didn't need your little
She was my sugar mama.
Chump change.
I mean, that first paycheck came in, we were just like, oh my gosh. So, which was great because we paid down a ton of debt.
Yeah.
When we got married, I mean, my wife, bless her, she married into a lot of, I had a lot of student debt.
Yeah.
She had zero. And so we immediately, as soon as we could, started that Dave Ramsey snowball.
Yeah.
And paid off a lot of debt thanks to a good job. Mm-hmm. And then I was doing school, and then I got a part-time job here at the church. As the worship pastor.
So how long had you moved here before you went through the door at Grand Parkway?
5 days, maybe.
Oh, five. Okay, the first place checked out. You checked out any place else?
No. Okay. It was really funny. We wanted a church that had, at the time, we wanted a church that had three things. We wanted a church where the preaching was expository.
Yeah.
Meaning that, you know, they didn't do topical
They weren't winking at the Bible. They were, going through the verses, the text in there.
Yeah.
Letting the text speak to it.
That's exactly right. They wouldn't skip over the tricky parts or the hard parts.
Right.
You know, a couple years ago, you know, Neil and the staff, they preached through Exodus. You know, it's like they get to the passages and it's like, what in the world is this talking about? We figured it out, you know? And so another way of saying that is we want a church that valued the Bible.
Yeah.
Right. And I've been to churches that do and that don't. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I, we just had a hunger for that. The second thing, we wanted a church that was elder led. And that was more of just growing up and seeing the dysfunction we saw in churches and realizing that there's a better way to do this.
The biblical safeguard that's.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And again, going back to the Bible.
Yeah.
Call me crazy. And then, and we wanted a church that had community groups. And that was because we had such a positive experience with community groups when we lived in Baton Rouge. You know, we didn't lead it, but we hosted one out of our home, which was funny because we were one of the few that actually had a home we could afford rent and to rent an actual house. And it was wonderful. But anyway, so we immediately, started trying to find a community group and it took us a while. Hmm. But we got plugged in eventually to a great community group. And then I don't know, I'd been here. It was probably about Christmas. I said to Neil.
Now, how long had Neil been here at that point?
So we started attending here in 2011. So I believe Neil started in 2006.
I think so.
I think it was about 5 years by that point.
Yeah.
So yeah, I said to him, hey, I noticed y'all have that piano on the stage. Nobody plays it. If y'all ever need anybody, I was real kind of, hey, if you need anything. And he's like, yeah, hey, talk to this guy. And so, they got me up there and started playing. And Ross King, who, you know, a lot of people at our church know, he was kind of the interim worship leader that time.
Who does not play piano?
Crazy for me. Ross is he's
guitarist?
An acoustic guy.
Yeah.
I think he plays piano as well, mostly does guitar. But what was amazing was Ross was a worship leader for a few different camps that I went to when I was in high school.
Yeah.
And I remember being in high school going, man, this guy is awesome. I want to be just like him. Yeah.
They call it performance disease, where the person on the platform, we revere them. Mm. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was a real humble guy. I mean, he was just, And so I was like, oh my gosh, this is, and Neil mentioned, one Sunday. Yeah. By the way, Ross is our interim. And I was like, wait, he's not the worship leader here. So, and I told Neil, hey, I can play piano. Anyway, fast forward.
Yeah.
I'm playing with Ross and I'm like, holy smokes, I'm playing piano for Ross King.
A little surreal moment for you. Yeah.
And at some point, you know, I think Ross had told the elders, hey, this is a short-term deal. You know, he was, he lived up in Bryan and he actually since moved to Nashville, but he told him that I'm interim. Mm-hmm. And then he said to them, hey, Clyde can do this.
Yeah.
Which, you know, when I found out, I was like, oh my gosh. So
knowing he said that, what feelings were?
Oh, it was very affirming. Yeah. Okay. It was very affirming. And, you know,
was it also scary?
Not at the time.
Okay.
No. What was scary for me was just, I mean, you have a responsibility to get up in front of people. I never led at a church this large or in a room that large. And so that was the scary part. I'm meeting with elders, developing a relationship with Neil throughout all this. And probably about March, I'm having conversations with them.
Had you been here a year yet?
Not quite a year. No. Okay. And so they offered me the job and I started May 20th of 2012.
Okay.
And this May it'll be 10 years.
Wow.
So, and it was part-time. I'm doing seminary.
And they
know.
And are you still thinking, I'm a seminary, this is part-time, we're going to go to the mission field? That's still
right.
Okay.
That was still my understanding. That was still my wife's understanding. Yeah. And I was probably 2 years into seminary, 2 years into our time here, and realized that calling had shifted.
Okay.
We weren't called to the mission field. We were called to the local church.
Okay.
And to serve as a worship pastor. Yeah. You know, and I love my time at Southwestern for some reasons. You know, I had a great education when it came to I tell people this and like, what? My concentration was actually in biblical languages, studying Greek and Hebrew. Okay. And it wasn't like in music or anything like that. And it was just a Master of Divinity, you know, which is kind of a general degree that pastors would get. But I'd initially gone for concentration in missions and just didn't get what I felt like I needed from seminary education.
Yeah.
My mission education came from being in a church and going on mission trips. You know, so our first one we did was in India, did a lot in Costa Rica when the Cardies were there. And
Through Grand Parkway.
And those were just amazing experiences for me and learning, okay, this is what it actually looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And through that realization, I was just like, well, then just serve the local church. So that's why we're here and why we do what we do now.
What do you view your role is, during our worship services?
So I have a very simple answer to that. And I have a more
nuanced.
Yeah. the very simple answer is my job is to get people to sing.
Okay.
That's
how we could measure.
Yeah, if you wanted to measure.
A way to measure.
Yeah. Because if you look in the Bible in the New Testament for the qualifications of an elder or a pastor, right? There aren't different kinds of pastors so much. I mean, don't get me wrong. I know there are different kinds of pastors. you're the spiritual formation pastor, I'm the worship pastor, but those titles aren't in the Bible.
Yeah.
Right. There's just pastor.
Yeah.
And so somebody that shepherds the people of God. And I believe that the primary way that looks is with what we could call a lead pastor or someone who handles the load of preaching. Mm-hmm. Because whoever's handling the word of God, that the word of God is our only authority. So that has to be the authoritative voice, and everything's got to be under that umbrella. And again, the great thing about our church is we have a plurality of elders who can rightly, you know, divide God's word. But for me, when I say getting people to sing, that sounds very unspiritual in some ways. Because, you know, Bono, you too, they can get people to sing, right?
Yeah.
But where that comes from is when you read the New Testament, Paul doesn't say a ton about our worship services.
Mm-hmm. What it should look like. And
you know, and neither did Jesus. I mean, at that time, they're still doing Jewish worship, right? Yeah. But Paul says, speak to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs when you gather. And so there's
Is that a command when he does? When
absolutely.
It's a command. So he's not just like a suggestion.
It's not a suggestion.
Hey, here's something you should try.
It's exactly command. Right. It is, okay, I just told you all this. Therefore, because I told you all this, sing to each other. And a lot of people miss that. They think we sing to God. Mm-hmm. We do. But the Bible says twice, Colossians and Ephesians, speak to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, which just means different kinds of songs. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean, some people think that means all psalms, and because old Puritans thought you only do psalms.
The Psalter, right?
We don't believe that. Do different kinds of songs. Do old songs, do new songs, do hymns, do, you know, newer stuff. And so but it's a command to speak to each other, because when we speak to each other, when we hear each other singing, there is something that happens there where we mutually encourage each other and edify each other and teach each other through the songs we sing. Because songs teach, right? If I start humming, you know, it's come thou long, you know, come thou fount of every blessing. Because that's the beauty of how music works. And, the music can be very helpful.
I mean,
back to how I view my role as a pastor in the moment in our services. I mean, it's more than just singing. I want to get people to sing, but I also want them to engage their heads and their hearts with what God is saying and what God has done for them. I think this is kind of a little side illustration. I think one of the great things about music in terms of when we use it in worship is it gets people ready to die. It gets them ready to meet God. Right?
Say that again. So it gets
people ready to die.
Like physically die.
Yeah. It prepares your soul for, especially when you sing a song about heaven or trials or death. Yeah. It reminds you that, you know, I think about when he shall come with trumpet sound. Oh, may I then in him be found. There's this thing of where this life is going to be done. God's coming back.
Yeah.
He's sending his son Jesus on a white horse to, and it'd be the sound of a trumpet. It's like, we're gone. Here we go. And so when I say songs get us ready to die, they shape us in such a way that we're ready for those difficult moments, you know? And I don't think everybody.
And that can be die to self, ultimately die, but also I got 1,000 miniature deaths I'm doing before I ultimately die.
Yeah. Sanctification.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also, I mean, on a real practical level, I mean, there's great. I remember I think you've interviewed them, the Coopers, when their daughter
Bailey,
died. I was really honored. They asked me to lead a hymn at the funeral, and it was, I mean, it was a large funeral. There were a lot of people there, we sang the hymn, How Firm a Foundation. And, you know, there were enough people there that knew that hymn that had gone to church. And I mean, just that moment,
the emotion, power
of those voices together, that's speaking to one another in psalms and spiritual songs. That's that mutual edification that happens. And it was just a powerful moment that leaves a mark on you, you know? And so that, and that happens, you know, That happens. Something really special can happen at a funeral when people experience those moments where they hear a song that's been with them throughout their life. Don't be wrong; it can happen with something newer. Another great example: a man who he's since gone to be with the Lord, but his name's Tom Holton. He had a song that he loved called "Holy Spirit," which is a newer song. By Brian and Katie Torwall, I think that we did at his funeral, and Tom, I mean, he was he was older, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, I don't think things always necessarily fit into, you know, the holes that we right. think they, that we peg them into, but you wouldn't have thought this would be one of his favorite songs, but it was.
Yeah.
And so we did that song at his funeral, and it was real memorable as well. Just a great, very simple song about the presence of the Holy Spirit in our lives.
You mentioned the power, how God designed music, where it's a pretty incredible tool for us to, I guess, learn, be catechized. So we learned, you know, mm-hmm. to teach. So my kids began listening to 80s music,
mm-hmm.
and I think I'm mildly impressing them with how many words I remember at all these songs. and at the same time, I'm mildly like alarmed. Why do I know all these words?
Mm-hmm.
It's this experience of music. And I don't know if I'm going to know the next line. Oh, I know the next line, that one too. And so I think about, you know, when I treat singing too casually here, am I doing myself a disservice in, like my own growth? Am I stunting my own growth by kind of going through the motions sometimes?
We all bring our preferences to the table. I don't think it's healthy to say, to just kind of whitewash everything and say, well, just get over it. You need to do this style. But at the same time, if our individual preferences rule the day, then we start to do ourselves a disservice. Okay. One, because we could be missing out on something that's great, mm-hmm. right? You know, I used to hate Brussels sprouts, and man, now I love them.
I love them. Okay.
They hadn't been prepared the right way.
Okay. Not raw.
No, not raw. So to go back to what you were saying about, you know, kind of our preferences, we can do ourselves a disservice.
Yeah.
But at the same time, our tastes, our preferences are what make music powerful.
Yeah.
And so that can be a challenge sometimes when you've got so many different people with so many different tastes.
Yeah.
Of what should we be doing with music, you know? Because if you start listing off different bands or personalities that have done this for a long time, whether it's, you know, Chris Tomlin or Matt Redman or, you know, Bethel or Hillsong or City of Light, all this kind of different stuff, it's you know, well, I'm with them. Well, I'm with them. Mm-hmm. I'm with Paul. I'm with Apollos.
Blah, 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 blah. Right.
Which is why for me, what really guides me is back to what I said earlier. I want to get people to sing. Mm-hmm. Can they sing it? Doesn't mean I don't do stuff from other, you know, people that's kind of hard to sing.
Mm-hmm.
It just means that the main source of the diet for our people is going to be songs that some guy that comes in doesn't have a musical bone in his body can jump in on it.
It's accessible to that person.
It's accessible enough that there's something there. It's like when you go swimming at the pool. You know, if you're a little kid, you can go up on the side of the pool and jump out. You know, and get out and jump back in.
Yeah.
But if you're a little older or you're kind of weak, you need those rails to kind of pull yourself in the steps to get up out of the pool. And there's people on a Sunday morning, they can just grab the edge of the pool and get out.
Yeah.
But there's also people here, they're not there. They need some rails. They need a hand to kind of help them up. And sometimes that's through the song itself. It's just easy to grab onto. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's with saying something like, hey, this is an older song. Mm-hmm. Or that you may not know this one. Here's what it's saying, and think about that as we sing it, and then invite them to come along. I also think that part of my responsibility is my role in our worship services is kind of a again, I like to, you mentioned baking. I love to cook in general, but is to kind of think of myself as a cook,
okay,
or a chef, someone that, you know, takes care of their family, right?
Yeah.
And so. I don't feed my kids, or my wife doesn't feed our kids garbage. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like we're going and buying them French fries and burgers every day, right? As much as I'm sure they would love that.
Right.
We try to serve different things. Mm-hmm. And it's, don't get me wrong, there's some standards that we want to eat and enjoy, right?
Yeah.
But there's also things where, you know, I want to expose them to something different they've never had. And so When I think about that for the worship pastor, that means that the songs cannot all just be about one thing.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot always be about what makes us happiest or what feels the best or what is most familiar.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to have songs in there that help us get through the hard times in life. When you look at the Psalms, right? The majority of the Psalms, if we had to give them a musical genre, are the blues, right? They're sad. They're sad songs. They're God, why have you forsaken me?
Yeah.
God, where are you right now?
Yeah.
I like to think of them as songs for people that don't want to sing a song.
That's good. And God gives us words to sing to him.
That's right. Yeah. God gives the words, right? It's not something we have to create on our own.
Yeah.
And so I want to make sure that we're not as, I don't think it has to be balanced.
Yeah.
But it does need to be varied enough to represent the full counsel of the Bible.
Yeah.
When it comes to this, the spiritual diet of our songs here at the church.
That's helpful. I think so. If I'm experiencing, oh, this song, this is not one of my favorites. Like, it might not be your favorites, but it, like, it might be a deficiency in your spiritual diet, and God just brings it to the table that day.
Yeah.
How has the music ministry changed while you've been the lead here at Grand Parkway? You said they had a piano up there, no one played it. Is that a good way to recruit people? Like, let's put stuff up there that people do. How long you let that set empty?
Haven't had to do that anymore. Okay. Yeah. Piano's like a piece of furniture, so it's pretty obvious. It'd be obvious if we had drums up there too. But we've I would say the first thing that came to my mind when you asked that question is numerically.
Okay.
We, in terms of who's on the stage leading on a Sunday morning, has changed. When I first started, it was me and about three or four others, and that was it. And,
okay.
And you were wearing people out. Mm-hmm. You know,
you have one service or two at that time.
We had two
at that
and
time.
Then
okay.
Quickly moved to three.
Okay.
So when I started in May of 2012, we were at two services. By August, we were at three.
Wow.
Okay. And we've been at three since then.
Since then.
So here in a few weeks,
and glory to God, we're going back to two. Woo! Yes.
Yes. So, but the worship team, in terms of who's up there, has changed and grown to where we've got around 30 musicians that I could lean on if I
volunteer
needed to,
musicians.
You know,
yeah,
four different drummers, and bass players, electric players. It's been amazing, and people come, and people leave. You know, some people have come into the ministry and they've needed to step out, and then I've got others that have been with me for almost 10 years now. Mm. And then so that's one change, the numerical change. Also, though, I have changed.
Okay.
Over, you know, almost 10 years now. My relationship with Neil, our lead pastor, has been a big part of that, because even though Neil would say, you know, he can't carry a tune in a bucket, he as a pastor, he has a good, and because he spent so much time around other worship leaders over the years, and kind of saw what was good. He saw the good and the bad.
Yeah.
He's been great at helping me, like a midwife almost, just bringing out what's there.
Mm-hmm. Refining this gifting.
Yeah. And him and the other elders as well. But, you know, Neil's who I work with mostly on a week-to-week basis with all that in terms of what our services need to look like. And so that's, you know, I don't lead and think the same way I led and thought 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And then another thing that's changed is just the responsibility. When it started off, it was, okay, Clyde, plan the service, lead the service. Mm-hmm. And plan and shepherd with the band in mind and growing that. Well, now it's, okay, the people that I've got that are on the stage, but I've also got a large group of people that are not on the stage that I'm responsible for.
Yeah.
So people running sound, people running the screens, the lyrics, the sermon notes, the videos, people that actually do the live stream.
Right.
The lights, all of that is now a part of what I think about when it goes into a Sunday morning. And so the camera is kind of panned back or, zoomed back. And there's more that is in the picture now in terms of what I think about for the worship ministry. That's been a big change as well.
Yeah. Is that all orbiting in your brain as you're up there leading, or?
If I'm not careful, it will.
Okay.
It'll be to a point where it's distracting, because there's just so much that can go wrong.
Yeah.
And that if you're not careful, I mean, I try to prepare well, and do things ahead of time so that I'm not caught off guard, and so that I'm not creating work for myself or somebody else in the moment. But when things go wrong, it's easy to get distracted and lose focus on what I'm supposed to be doing in the moment of leading worship, which is getting these people's minds on God,
yeah.
what we're singing about.
Yeah.
So it can be, yeah. But the more I've done it, the longer I've done it, I like to think the better I've gotten at
yeah.
not letting that happen.
Yeah. The persons who are listening and they might be just wondering, I don't know, maybe serving in music is for me. What do you say to them?
Come talk to me. I would love to talk. We're always looking to grow the ministry.
What about someone who's thinking, I think worship leading, I think that's something I'm really curious about.
Yeah, I would, again.
Do we need more worship leaders?
We do, yeah. We need to equip the saints to do the ministry mm-hmm. that's been given them. And that's been one of the great things. Again, like I said, numerically, one of the things that's been good is other people have come that
yeah.
I don't have to be here every Sunday.
Yeah.
You know, I've got other people mm-hmm. that can do this as well.
Are there persons who've been a part of this music ministry and whatever reasons God has moved them somewhere else? And now in some ways, you know, we have a hand in a blessing that church that they're a part of now.
Not yet, but I would love that.
We'd love that. Okay.
Down the road. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Not yet.
Your call to, I think, ministry and missions, now ministry and local church. Was that an overnight thing? Was that a, look at Nicole, I think this has changed. Was it a slow?
I would say it was a process over a few months.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't overnight. But it became clear, especially once the conversation started happening with the elders mm-hmm. here of, we had thought this was going to be another kind of short-term, yeah. few years type of yeah. deal, but now the conversation has changed.
Yeah,
again, going back to that midwife analogy, mm-hmm. If there's a baby here, let's give birth to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and there was.
You have four children; they're all very young.
Yes,
oldest is
she turns 8 this weekend.
The youngest is what? Not quite one.
Youngest is 3 months old.
Oh, not even near one.
Is that right? Yeah, he's 3 months old. Yeah.
Is there any kind of lingering that all the kids are out of school? Maybe the mission field still calls us?
No.
Okay.
No. I think when I've said this multiple times to people, it'll probably get me in trouble one day, I'm sure, but I want to die at this church. Mm. And I'm not saying that I'm like, I need to hold on to this white knuckle.
Right, right.
That would be horrible. Right. So I don't want to do that. But going back to my experience, I saw a lot of churches where, and I've seen a lot of men in my time in ministry mm. where they would be a pastor of a church for 2 years, maybe mm-hmm. 3 years, and then they're gone. Mm. And I'm shocked by how often that happens. And I'm not saying that every time that happens, it's bad. Mm-hmm. People have different reasons for mm-hmm. coming and going to churches. But I think when that is the life of a church where their pastors are there for two mm-hmm. or 3 years and then they're gone, I don't think that there's no way that can be healthy.
Yeah.
And so
long-term health, that situation.
No. Yeah.
I've been here about 2.5 years. I feel like I just still don't even know everybody's name.
Exactly. So, I've been here 10.
How can I be done with what I'm supposed to do?
And that's one of the things I love about this church. In general, most of the staff have been, you know, very tenured. Mm. They've been here a while.
Yeah.
And if they've left, they've been here a while before they left.
Yeah.
And I remember being in seminary, reading about pastors of churches in the era of Jonathan Edwards, you know, that
early
1700s.
Yeah, yeah.
His Jonathan Edwards, you know, he's a great American theologian. His grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, mm-hmm. I think was his name.
Mm-hmm.
He had pastored that church for 30 plus years. And
Northampton.
Somewhere in Massachusetts. Yeah, Northampton. Yeah. And that was common.
That was the norm.
That was the norm.
Yeah. Yeah,
and pastors back then kind of viewed their relationship with their church mm-hmm. as a covenant. Mm-hmm. Now, right or wrong, mm-hmm. You know, because I think of covenant, I think of marriage. I'm mm-hmm. committed to my wife for life. She's committed to me for life. I don't think that necessarily has to be true with with every church.
Right.
But I wonder what it would look like if more people approached it with that.
A lot of long-term commitment.
Because it takes grit to do that.
Yeah.
It takes, okay, we're going to figure this out. Yeah. I'm not going to leave when it gets hard, when you get hard, when you're hard to pastor or I'm hard to deal with as a pastor. We're going to figure out a way to make this work.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not saying that's a blanket that we just need to put over every situation, but you can't read the Bible and walk away going, they just stayed for a few years and moved on.
Yeah.
And that was their pattern for their life. I don't know how we got on that topic, but I want to be here. You asked about missions down the road. Yeah. If God calls us to it, great.
Right.
But God has us here in our kids. You know, I want my kids to grow up and have fulfilling lives in the Lord. And then I want that to free me and my wife up so we can do more.
Yeah.
You know, I want, there's things that my wife would love to do that she can't because she's a mom of four kids.
Right.
There are opportunities we would love to give to or give our time to that we just can't because of the season. And, so once that changes, we would love to be able to do more.
Are you able to, are any of your kids musical?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Are you forcing piano lessons on them?
No. I don't think it's a good, I've known some parents that could do it. I don't think in general, it's probably a good idea to teach lessons to your kids because I've helped my oldest EVK along some. Yeah. She is hungry for it. And that's one of the things that I need to figure out. Am I going to do this or not?
Yeah.
Or just pay someone to do it.
Yeah.
So she likes playing the piano and she has pretty good, she's getting okay at it, for an 8-year old.
Yeah.
And then my second daughter, Mabel Grace, is a really great singer. Mm. She brings tears to my eyes.
She can
sometimes.
Be on pitch.
She matches
age.
Pitch really well.
Wow.
And what's funny about that is she is deaf in one ear. She has a unilateral hearing loss, and yet she's the best singer in our family. Really, in a lot of ways for our kids.
Yeah.
And then Nora, the next one, she turns 3 next month, and she's a great singer.
Mm.
So we'll see what happens with Theodore. You know, I'm like, I don't care if you are musical or not. Just get your mom's brains, and her grades in school, and we'll be fine.
Yeah. And so as we're talking, we're probably weeks away from opening the new sanctuary here on campus. Mm-hmm. And how will this change our worship experience? How will it change? What do you see down the road?
I really don't want anything to change. Selfishly, I'm not saying we don't need to change. I think we're always growing and always learning, but what I don't want to see happen is people to think, oh, it's bigger. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes more, more about the performance, mm-hmm. more about excellence. And people throw performance out there like it's a bad thing or production mm-hmm. out there like it's a bad thing. I don't have a problem with those words as much as I don't want it to feel like we have changed as a church. It goes back to what I said. My job is get people to sing. Same. Are we singing? Yeah. Are we in this together? Are y'all watching us on a stage? You know, one of the things I love about the stage in the new church is it kind of wraps around a little bit the chairs.
Yeah.
So everybody's actually looking at each other mm-hmm. a little bit more. So I would love that to, the focus isn't on what's being, done on a stage, focuses on what is God saying in the room. Yeah. One of the things I do want to happen with a new building is we grow as a church numerically, and there's nothing wrong with numerical growth, mm-hmm. but I want that to allow us to do things before that we haven't been able to do.
Yeah.
One being we go from 3 services to 2 services.
Not because of less people, there's a lot more room.
Yeah, and really, when the more services you have, the more you have to divide the church up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's like pastoring 3 different churches.
Mm-hmm. It very much can be. Yeah,
So the more we can spend time together and not have to split it up, the better.
Mm-hmm. So with people listening, if there's this passage in Philippians where Paul's making this argument to them, make my joy complete by basically having Christ mindless. If people wanted to make Clyde's joy complete, sing. Mm. Sing when you're at church.
Yeah, absolutely. Sing whether you think you can sing or not.
Yeah.
and it's funny you mentioned Philippians, you know, which I, the more I read Philippians, the more I'm like, that's the joy book of the New Testament. Because Paul says the word joy so much, you know, it gets to chapter four, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice, you know. There's this great part in chapter one, it's like verse 23, I think, where Paul talks about how he works for their progress and for their joy.
Yeah.
And that's really my prayer for our people. I want us to be marked by those two things, progress and joy.
Yeah.
Progress, spiritual progress, numerical progress, growth progress. That's great. Growth is not always going to look the way we think it will. You know, I've been here at the church now almost 10 years. I've seen growth like I've never seen before in any other church. It's been, it's been great for me. But the progress has been more spiritual than it has been numerical.
Yeah.
And then, but also joy. It is easy for me. My wife, she reaches over when I'm driving in traffic, and she's just like, "No joy right now. You have no joy." Because Houston traffic just does something to me, where it brings out some probably sinful tendencies. Yeah. Where I'm like, "I need to teach people how to drive right now," and she's like, "No joy." I'm like, "Okay, I'll just ease off." And, you know,
Clyde's so, driving school, everybody.
Yeah. So. Not my job to teach people how to drive. So, but joy is it's easy to lose the joy if you're focused on things that if you're focused on what makes men happy, other people.
Yeah,
it's a great old hymn we used to sing. I'd rather have Jesus than man's applause. Mm. Man's applause sounds good.
Yeah.
But eventually it's like a drug. I need more and more and more and more if that's what brings me joy.
Yeah.
But if God's what brings me joy, man, that is a well that I'm never going to tap out. Mm-hmm. That there's depth there that it's always going to leave me wanting more in a good way, in a healthy, fulfilled way where I can go, whoo.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So one last question. How would you just explain your experience of calling to ministry to a 10-year-old? To a little kid.
For me, it comes to the word obedience.
Okay.
So God has made it clear to me in my life through my reading of the Bible, through my prayer life, and through the voices of people around me that you need to lead people in singing songs to God. For me not to do that, excuse me, for me not to do that would be disobedience.
Be sin
to God.
Yeah.
Yeah. My calling is not, excuse me, my view of calling is not if I could do anything else, go do that. Right. My calling, my view of calling really comes down to obedience. It would be disobedient for me to do something else. And it doesn't mean I can't teach. It doesn't mean I can't do other things, but God's made it clear you're going to do this.
Yeah.
And you're going to do it well, and that's obedience.
Yeah. I thank you. I really enjoyed this. I know our people will. I want to thank you for giving us a listen. And if someone came to mind who would benefit from this conversation, go ahead and send them the link to this content. Invite them to listen. If you've heard a few episodes, do us a favor and give us a 5-star review wherever you listen to podcasts. For some reason, in the mystery of magic and algorithms, this makes it easier for people to find this podcast. If you have suggestions for other stories, you can always contact me, blake@grandparkway.org. These are the stories you've missed.